Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join Bradford author Sarah Hussain for a special discussion on her latest novel, Hidden Fires, in conversation with journalist and author Yusra Samir. Set during Ramadan 2017, the story weaves a poignant narrative between Yusef, haunted by a nightmarish past, and his granddaughter Ruby, who confronts the cultural clash of their lives when she moves to London. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this powerful discussion delves into the complexities of personal and collective history.
Welcome, everybody. I'm so excited to be speaking to Bradford-born and bred Sarah Hussain. And I'm super excited because I read her second novel, Hidden Fires, which is what this event is all about, at the end of 2023. And I've been gagging to learn all about it, you know, what's went on behind the scenes. So this is just as exciting for me, hopefully, as it is for all of you. So a quick sentence about me. My name is Yusra Samir Imran. I'm an author and a journalist, and I'm actually based here in West Yorkshire as well. But this event is not about me, it's about Sarish. So a little bit about Sarish. She is the author of two novels, The Family Tree, which came out in 2020, literally in the month of COVID when we went into the first lockdown. And The Family Tree was shortlisted for a number of awards, including the Costa First Novel Award. And Hussain has actually also been called one of the UK's unmissable writers. Sarah Hussain is also a lecturer in creative writing. And she was a finalist in the Women's Prize and Good Housekeeping Futures Award. Hidden Fires is her second novel. And I've got my copy with me today. This is what it looks like. So, quick show of hands. Who's read The Family Tree? Very good. If you haven't, you're missing out. And who's read Hidden Fires? Ah, superb. So that's like just over 50% of the room. So I'm going to be very careful not to give away any spoilers today. So with Hidden Fires, it's set in 2017. And it starts off on the night of the Grenfell fire. The novel weaves a poignant narrative between Yusuf, who is a widowed survivor of the India-Pakistan partition and lives in Bradford, and he suffers flashbacks to his past. And then Ruby, who is his teenage granddaughter doing her GCSEs, whose parents dump her on Yusuf's doorstep after a family member unexpectedly passes away. And then a sort of tense relationship forms between the two of them, as neither of them really sort of get each other, or there's some sort of cultural misunderstandings. But with time, a really beautiful relationship starts to blossom between grandfather and granddaughter, and they grow on each other and come to help each other with all their hidden secrets and their trauma. So that's a little bit about the book. So how this is going to go is we're going to do about half an hour discussion between me and Sarish delving into Hidden Fires. And then Sarish will do a quick reading from her book. And then we will do about 15 minutes Q&A. Right, Sarish, are you ready?
Yes, I am. And thank you, everyone, so much for coming. Like, I didn't expect an almost full room. And I'm really excited to be here with you, Yusra. We've been trying to get together like this and do a little Q&A or something for a while now, haven't we? And it's not quite worked out. So this is just as exciting for me as
thank
it
is you, Brad, for Literature Festival.
Yay, thank you, guys.
Right, so in Hidden Fires, it's quite interesting because we've got three POVs. The chapters swap between Yusuf, the grandfather, is he in his 80s? Or did I just make that up?
Yeah, he's 80.
He's widowed and he lives on his own. And then we've got his son, Hassan, who's middle-aged and a social worker. And he has just the one daughter, Ruby, who we also get a POV from. And she's around 16 and doing her GCSEs. However, the one main character that we don't get a POV from in first person is Michelle Ruby's mother. We sort of view her throughout the novel from a distance. What I want to know, Sarish, was this intentional?
The way it started out, it was supposed to be a first-person dual narrative. We were going to alternate between Yusuf Ruby because, you know, the characters are very different, you know, different generations, ages, upbringings, everything. So I thought the contrast is brilliant and we're going to say the same events are going to be happening, but we're going to, you know, view it from these two very unique points of view. But, you know, sort of as I was writing, it did feel like there was something missing. You know, just the family, a bit of backstory about the family, you know, why they are where they are at the moment, that was missing. So I had some conversations with my editor and she said, you know, her son is the link between these two characters. You know, he's Yusuf's son, he's Ruby's father. Why don't we bring him in? Now, with the family tree, for those of you who have read it, there are like three protagonists, and I was really adamant I don't want to do that again. You know, I went a bit over the top, a bit off more than I could do, I felt. And I said, I'm going to write a simple book, you know. Yeah, so that didn't quite work out. Her son was brought in, but he only comes in sometimes. He's not, you know, it's not like Yusuf Ruby. He comes in when he's needed. He kind of, you know, gives the narrative a bit of breathing space, I think, and provides that sort of backstory. Now, with Michelle, it troubled me that she's this silent sort of character. You know, I felt that she was a bit passive and I did want to bring her in, but I would have just ended up with another monster of a book because then all of her life experience, all of, you know, her opinions, her viewpoints would have had to been written. And I kind of made the decision not to do that. I thought we'd get her as a mother through Ruby, but I thought her son really does give us a real insight into her because of the way he experiences her illness, the way they've tried to navigate that as a family. So I felt like even though we don't get her point of view, she's still very three-dimensional compared to when I was first writing it. She was basically this non-entity and that really bothered me. So I hope that I've managed to achieve that and she does appear in the pages of the book as a whole person. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, this is going off into a tangent, but I actually said that to you, like, I have this habit, right, with, like, my author friends. When I read their books, I, like, live text them or I send them voice messages, like, live reactions to what I'm reading. And I told Sarish, like, just how grateful I was for the representation of invisible illnesses. So Michelle, Ruby's mother, has fibromyalgia. And I also have like an invisible chronic illness / disability. And I just resonated so much with what it's like to be a mother. And in your head, there's so many things you want to do with your child. Then you wake up in the morning and you have like a flare up of symptoms or you have chronic fatigue and you're unable to. So for me, it was really interesting because I could resonate with Michelle, but it was also really interesting because I got to see how Ruby, the child, felt and how sometimes she sort of felt like she was missing out on things. So yeah, I thought that was really, really interesting.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. And that, because I did write from experience because my mum suffers from something similar. So it was interesting sort of, I suppose, writing through Ruby's point of view, I've experienced that directly. But then, you know, it's like trying to put yourself in the mother's point of view, but then also as a, you know, as a spouse, you know, her son he's trying to deal with so much and he feels, when he's exhausted, he feels bad, you know, supporting somebody through that. He should, you know, he feels like as though he should always just be there, this pillar of strength, and he can't always be that person. So it was interesting for me too, to try and look at it from all points of view.
Yeah, I think you definitely hit all angles. And I think one takeaway that I should take from this is that I should be much nicer to my husband. So without us giving away any spoilers, for those who haven't read it, obviously the novel kicks off on the night of the Grenfell fire. Why did you choose this particular historical event as the anchor point for Yusuf's flashbacks as opposed to like any other historical event?
The reason for that is because I guess that summer of 2017, a lot was happening at that time, and that's where the novel, the idea for the novel came from. So that was the year that I got my book deal. That was the year that I met my publisher here at Bradford Literature Festival. I was called, so it was basically as we are now, you know, 2 weeks later, I was invited down to London. And just before the Bradford Literature Festival, it had been Ramadan. And I had woken up, like so many people, in the middle of the night to keep a fast for Ramadan and watched the tower, the beginning of all that absolutely horrific event that took place. And it's hard to describe. I think it's, if you woke up and you switched the telly on and you saw that, that's horrendous enough. But actually being there and watching it live, because there were people obviously who'd kept a fast, who'd come on from the mosque and had alerted, you know, the residents to what was happening. It's something that is just, I guess, you know, for everyone who watched it, you know, waking up during that time as well, it's supposed to be so peaceful. It's the middle of the night, you're so reflective and, you're in that sort of zone. And then witnessing such a horrific thing on your telly is just awful. So that was kind of playing on my mind. Then I got my book deal at the festival and I went down to London. So it was a few weeks after the Grenfell Tower fire that I went down to London. And I did feel that there was just this atmosphere. There was definitely just this somber, the capital, it was somber. You know, everyone's kind of grieving, reeling from what had happened. And the first question that my publisher asked me wasn't about Hidden Fires. The first question they asked me was, are you writing another book? And I was like, yeah. Like, you know, I was not writing another book. I had no idea for another book. I was like, why are you asking me about that? I want to talk about The Family Tree. So they said, but you need to start thinking about, you know, you need an idea. I was like, okay, no pressure. So I had a few sort of sleepless nights in the months that followed about what can I write about. And then it was August 2017, which was the 70th anniversary of the partition of India. And I started watching all the documentaries. It's something that's always interested me. And I started watching all the programs and it ignited. Every few years, I kind of have this real interest that gets ignited with the partition and I do all my research and then it goes away and then it comes back. So it came back at that time. So the way that the events of that summer followed, that's almost how the book is sort of written. And yeah, we start at Grenfell because partition and Grenfell, they're very, very different. But, you know, if you think about it, both events happened because of catastrophic decisions made by people, made by the people in power. And the people that suffered the most were poor people, black and brown people. The deaths that occurred were unnecessary. So, yeah, they occurred in different timelines, historic periods, countries, but parallels can be drawn between them. And it just felt right that both these characters wake up in the middle of the night to keep her fast, they put the telly on and it kind of triggers, you know, use of sort of flashbacks. And yeah, it just felt right to start there.
I actually find that absolutely fascinating that you drew those parallels between the two events. And that leads on really nicely to my next question, which is obviously the central theme of Hidden Fires is partition. And without giving away any spoilers, there's a lot of really like heavy, traumatic stuff in the novel. You remember my live reaction? It was like nighttime and I was like, oh my God, I'm crying.
I was like, I'm sorry.
She was like, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to make you cry. And obviously I'm not of South Asian heritage, yet I connected and felt so deeply about, you know, the events based on real events that you'd written about. You're of Pakistani heritage. Like, was it quite traumatic for you when you were researching and writing about this?
It was. My first finding out about partition, I think I was about 9 years old. And there's like a famous Bollywood movie called Gadar, which I don't know. I'm sure people here it's got really cool songs. People here will have watched that film. And that's where I kind of realised, oh, I didn't know this thing. I didn't know India and Pakistan were one country. I didn't know the British were in there. I had no idea about any of this. So obviously, as was appropriate for a 9-year-old, my parents kind of explained what had happened. I was like, oh, okay. And then, I don't know, it just sort of held on to me. And I think every time there's been an anniversary and the BBC have put out their documentaries, I've kind of watched and been transfixed by it. So it wasn't that during the 70th anniversary, it wasn't like that was the first time I'd heard about it or I'd researched into it. Even at university, I did my like undergrad dissertation. I did it on partition literature. So it's always been there at the back of my mind. And I did kind of have this dream that, oh, I'd love to write, you know, a big epic partition novel. And, you know, it probably would have followed what is already out there. So some star-crossed lovers, maybe, you know, Hindu girl, Muslim boy, you know, falling in love. Or a group of friends who were all, you know, really close, but then partition happens and they're from different religious backgrounds and then their friendship disintegrates. That's the kind of thing that I'd read about and seen, you know, in artistic representations. What did you ask me? Because I've just gone off totally. What did you ask me?
So, obviously, because you're of Pakistani heritage, so, yeah. I mean, were you sat bawling your eyes out while writing?
Yeah. I've cried a lot over the years. Yeah, I mean, when you look at the actual human stories, it's absolutely devastating. Because, and I think it's, it lingers and it's still there. And I think people to this day feel like, why did this have to happen? Why did it have to happen the way in which it had to happen? You know, the idea that you can live side by side and the fact that your neighbours will turn on you. And I think the violence as well is absolutely monstrous. And it, for me, it's the women and what the women had to endure, because women are always, women and children, as we can see today, are always the sort of worst casualties. And yeah, it was traumatic. And I think for people who do go down that road, there's a certain strength that is required to even ask about it, because you cannot prepare yourself for what you're going to hear. So one of the documentaries that I watched with Anita Rani, the elderly gent said to her, "You're very strong to listen to this." And she's like, "I'm only asking you, but you're actually talking about it." But, you know, it's some of those people, and that's definitely what inspired Yusuf. Some of the people that were interviewed in these documentaries, they'd never spoken about it before. They probably hadn't been asked. There is this big conspiracy of silence that just don't talk about it. It's too painful. And all of them cried. So, like, seeing men cry, like your father or your, it's quite difficult, isn't it? Because they're always the strong, stoic ones. But, and then seeing, like, elderly men cry, you know, they're all so stoic and they have this stiff upper lip. But then people who look like your granddad, you know, the emotion just really poured out of them. And that's, that it's something that I just couldn't forget. It was such a powerful, it was such powerful viewing. And that's where I found Yusuf. And that's where I decided that this is a story that I need to tell. But even to this day, like some of the things that you have to read, like it's, and we've seen a lot. We're seeing a lot. I mean, the way that war is carried out now, we can just watch graphic videos on social media. None of it is sugar-coated, but this event still, like, if you go down the rabbit hole, is still absolutely horrific. So, yeah, it was very traumatic. Yeah.
And I think that's the power of historical fiction. And I'm not saying this just because, like, you're my mate, but honestly, I've read so many like non-fiction books about partition. Mm. I've watched so many documentaries about partition. Nothing like encapsulated the emotion and the horror the way that your novel did. So, well done.
Thank you.
So, a really beautiful relationship blossoms between this grandfather and this granddaughter, and I think this is something that's really special about your novel. We don't often see novels that explore a grandfather-granddaughter relationship and in the first person. How did you tap into like the mindset of an 80-year-old Pakistani grandfather? And then I'm going to ask the same question for Ruby, because even though we've been teenagers and everybody in this room has been a teenager at some point, not everybody in the room has become a grandparent yet. Mm. And Ruby is like from Gen Z, and Gen Z are like very different in terms of what they're into in comparison to what we were as millennials. Mm. So how did you sort of get into the minds of these two very different generations?
So I've had two different sets of feedback with the Ruby's character. Some people are like, wow, how did you capture the voice? It's so accurate the way that Ruby is. She's 16 years old and they're like, you know, you've done really well with that. You talk, you know, the way she talks, you've got it. And some people are like, wow, you're so cringe. Like, did you have to do that? So not everyone loves it. I'll let you guys be the judge of that. But I think with Ruby, I'm going to embarrass some of my students who are in the, I've got some of my students who are in the audience and they're going to all hide now. But I hang out with young people. I think they like me. I think they accept me. And I listen to how they talk and I kind of like stole from them. Stole from some of the conversations. I might have done that.
Were you like, wait a minute, can you just tell me what that term means?
Yeah. So I was doing a bit of that. It was probably like the embarrassing kind of, I won't say auntie because I'm not that old, but you know, embarrassing older sister. Yeah, we'll do that. So that I felt like that was quite easy. But my editor said, just calm down a bit. And she did. She said, just, you know, because colloquialisms, like, they age quite badly. So just, you know, take a chill pill. So I was like, okay. So that was Ruby. But with Yusuf, I just, again, so this is something strange about me. I love writing in from the male point of view much better than the female point of view. And the more different they are to me, the better. So with the family tree, Amjad, I absolutely loved writing from Amjad's point of view. So he's the middle-aged, widowed father. And yet Zara, who'd just finished university and was similar in age to me, I just hated it because I felt like, oh, she sounds like me. And I didn't like the way I sounded. Whereas Amjad, I could just sink right into that character. And I think the same thing happened here. I don't know, maybe I'm an 80-year-old granddad is what I actually am, but it just came really natural to me. Like, it just happened. And somebody actually said to me that it was one of the most accurate sort of older protagonists they'd read, so that was such a huge compliment. And this person works at the bookseller, so they've read a lot of books. So it really meant a lot. But I don't know how, I'm just weird, I guess. I don't know.
So quite early on in the novel, it becomes quite apparent that poor Yusuf has got like early onset dementia. Yeah. He's having a lot of falls, he's confused, he gets lost, got memory loss. And he's also quite lonely. He is very adamant about taking care of himself. So I was like having a think about our cultural communities, like Arab and South Asian, and how we sort of stereotype dementia as like this sort of old white person's illness. And very interestingly, I actually read that there's no actual words in Urdu or Punjabi for the word dementia. So were you intentionally giving use of dementia to raise awareness? And then also, very interestingly, did you also make him so lonely on purpose? Because again, like, I don't want to say everybody, but as like Asians and Arabs, when we get old, we just assume that we're going to have this very big extended family that will take care of us and that we're not going to like be put in like a care home. Like it's not a done thing in our communities.
No, absolutely, you're right. And I think whilst I was doing my PhD and my master's, I worked part-time at the local hospital, at the BRI, as an assistant in ultrasound. So that was 8 years of a lot of observing. And, you know, what you just described is what we think, but the reality is actually much, you know, a lot different. And a lot of people, and it is quite shocking because we are, as South Asians or Arabs, sort of ingrained that, yeah, when your parents get older, your grandparents get older, you look after them and that's that. You know, they're not going to go into a care home. That's idealistic. And the actual act of caring is very, very difficult. And I've kind of experienced this a little bit recently. I had to travel to Pakistan. My grandmother was very ill and there was so much family. There was never a quiet moment. Extended family, like, so aunties, uncles, and then their kids, and then cousins, second cousins. There's just people everywhere. And everyone was willing to just sort of chip in and help look after my grandma. I think that is very difficult to replicate here. And, you know, we kind of sit in our own little terraced houses or semis, you know. It's not that kind of big communal living type of arrangement. So what I tried to do with, I mean, obviously as a storyteller, and I was conscious of the fact that that is a kind of plot device, you know, you've got an elderly person who's got this, who's got dementia, and a family secret is then going to be revealed. And I did speak to, I was lucky because I've got one of my colleagues, Dr. Sarah Falkus, is like a scholar in aging narratives. So I said, look, am I being really stereotypical and awful, because I don't want to do that. So she kind of read the book very early on and gave me her approval, and she said that I, you know, was handling it sensitively. So I was really grateful for that. But we kind of did sort of like what you just said about the representations of this illness is mostly, it's kind of like, it is older white people. So the books like Saving Missy, Three Things About Elsie, Elizabeth Is Missing, which I'm sure people here have read, there isn't, we couldn't really think of anywhere the protagonist was like an elderly man or Asian, or, you know, so it was kind of like, okay, so I felt like I was doing something different then. The other aspect of it was that with the partition, the people who are still around to talk about those experiences, they are in their 80s now. We are losing them. And they were children at the time. If they can remember what happened, the oldest they could have been was about, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. That's still very young. But because it was so traumatic, they do still have memories, but they're not very clear memories. So it only made sense that this is something that Yusuf would have repressed and just hidden away in a dark corner. And when you do sort of experience those early symptoms of dementia, it's almost like, I think somebody described it as a bookcase, that the newest memories you lose first, but the older memories stay, and they're the ones that come back and jump out. So that's kind of what I tried to do with this, if that makes sense. Yeah,
that's amazing. That's the first time I've heard that. So
yeah,
just keeping my eye on the time. I think the biggest takeaway I took after reading Hidden Fires was that I've lived in Bradford. I don't anymore, but I lived for like a good 3.5 years. And you walk up and down Great Horton Road or Leeds Road, and you see elderly Asian grandmas and grandpas walking, doing their shopping, and you don't give them like a second look. And then after reading this, I was just like, oh my God, so many of them have survived partition, and they're actually like vulnerable, and they could be holding on to all of this trauma, and they could have all these hidden secrets like Yusuf. So I really like, it really made me see our elders in a new light, and with a lot, you know, newfound respect. And I felt kind of like ashamed of myself. Like, you know, when you look at, like, you could be looking at people, but you don't really see them. Now I do. Did you have anything? Did you find the same thing? Did you have a similar experience?
Yes, exactly that. And it was after my watching my documentaries, and I think I went to my, as I explained, watching all those people talk about that, you know, things that they'd experienced and the emotion that came from them, and then going to my grandma's house and her sending me down to the corner shop to get something, and just looking around and seeing, you know, the beards, the mosque hat, the shalwar kameez, the, you know, the grandmas and the grandpas, and just thinking they didn't have therapy. You know, they didn't have therapy. A lot of them haven't even been asked about the experiences. They've just got on with it, and they were just expected to get on with it. And they've been through something that's just unimaginable. And I felt ashamed as well, because you're right, you see people, but you don't. And I think also because, so I'm very different to my grandparents because of, they were born in Pakistan, they grew up there. You know, both my grandmas couldn't read. I was born here, I had an education here. I've done what I've done. So you feel like you love each other so much, but you're very different to each other. But how can you find a connection? And that's what I wanted to portray with this relationship with Ruby and Yusuf. They're very different to each other, but there is love there. But where does it come from? You know, And people talk about generational trauma, and I definitely think that's a thing, especially on that scale, when you've gone through something on that scale. And with our grandparents, like my granddad, like many people's granddads, came here in the like 60s. So it's not just that they've survived partition as children, but then they've uprooted and come to this new country and built a whole life here. And the amount of lived experience, some people don't even experience that at all, and they've gone through two huge momentous things, and the amount of stories that they have, and just the simple act of like, how often, you know, did you sit with your grandparent and ask them about their life? Because you're too busy doing stuff, you're too busy being a kid, and then you're too busy at school and college, and all they really crave is your company. And there's so much that I feel like we've probably missed out on because we didn't talk to them how we should have done. We didn't ask them about their life and their experiences. And yeah, I just wish, you know, because my granddad passed away when I was 12. I wasn't interested in the partition then. You know, I don't know if I would have asked, I probably would have asked him about it, but there's so much about his life that I don't know about. And I'm just finding stuff out now from things that my uncle might tell me. And I just wish I had that time to talk to him. And I've had people get in touch with me and say, like, you've inspired me to talk to my granddad and ask them about his life, or my grandma. And yeah, I've started waffling, but you know.
Well, yeah, and that's made me feel like our elders, they're like living history books. Mm. I meant that in a positive way, not as a, as an insult. Okay, so last question before I hand over to you to do your reading. Obviously, I'm desperate to know now, how long am I going to have to wait for a third book? And what are you working on at the moment, if anything else, like non-book related, yeah, but still like writing and publishing and literature?
I'm still thinking. I'm still waiting for an idea. I have an idea, actually, but it's very early. You might have to wait another 4 years. I'm sorry. So that's that. That's happening. It's early stages. What I'm working on. So are there any writers in the room? There must be. Don't be embarrassed to put your hands up. Yeah. Okay. When I say writer, I mean anyone who just writes. Yeah. Okay. So my friend, Michael, over there, and I, we're going to do a course, a residential course in Haworth. It's called How to Write a Novel and Get It Published, if anyone's interested. Michael, you've got some flyers, haven't you? Okay, he's ready. He's armed and ready. So it starts on the 2nd of September, and it finishes on the 7th, and that's the Haworth residential course, if anyone is interested. It's all about novel writing, so inspiration, world building, characterization, plotting, drafting, all those building blocks that, you know, writers need to create novels. There's also an online version which starts in September and it'll finish in December. So if you have any questions, feel free to ask me at the end, or Michael. I'm sure you'll stick around and you can ask Michael. I'm also doing a little workshop, if that's like too much and you just want a little taster. I'm doing a little workshop for the Haworth Festival on the 20th, Saturday the 20th. I think it's at 11. But I will share again on my social media if anyone wants to have a go at that. It's kind of about writing memories, writing, you know, using family stories to create a piece of writing, that kind of thing.
Oh my God, yeah. When I first moved to Yorkshire, I attended Haworth Writing Festival. Okay. If you've never been, so it's usually like mid-September. It's usually, is it the Bronte Parsonage Museum website where you book?
Michael.
Is it the Bronte Parsonage Museum, Nick? Oh, okay. Oh, okay. But like, there's so many writing things going on in
there
Haworth.
There is.
It's stunning there.
It is.
It's where obviously the Brontes
originally.
So like, I hope, like, whenever I go there, I hope that like their spirits are still in the air and that I can like,
it does, that's what happens,
capture some of
help
their like their writing geniusness. So yeah, I can't think of like a better place to do like a writing workshop than Haworth, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely.
Right, I'm going to stop waffling and you're going to give us a taster of your book and then we're going to go on to Q&A.
I'll just read a little snippet of from Ruby's point of view and then from Yusuf's, and just give you a flavour of both the characters. And both of them are in an anxious state, and I'm going to just read. So Ruby has woken up in the middle of the night and the phone's ringing. Somebody is obviously dead because the phone is ringing at 2 a.m. No one rings at that time unless someone has popped it, probably in the most brutal manner too, like a car crash or a suicide or something really, really messed up like that. My heart has started pounding at twice the speed. I don't know what is louder, the drumming in my ears or the jaunty ringtone piercing the still night. Shit, shit, shitty shit. Why won't someone go and answer it? I have a textbook practically stuck to the side of my face. Yuck. I pull it off and wipe away the dribble. Sitting up in bed, I contemplate for 10 seconds whether I should go and pick up the phone. Contemplation over. There's no way I'm going downstairs in the dark. I shuffle around and there's a loud thud as the rest of my GCSE revision guides fall to the floor. Just what we needed, more strange noises in the middle of the night. I must have left them in a pile on my bed and fallen asleep because, of course, nobody was going to come and check up on me. Not saying I want to be tucked in like a baby, but I am still wearing my jeans and have books stuck to me. So it would have been nice if someone had just come into my room and, oh, I think Dad is already downstairs. He must have fallen asleep on the sofa again. The banging seems to have done the trick because I can hear him moving. I suddenly feel bad because whoever is ringing probably thinks we're all awake because it's Ramadan and we should be awake, but we're not. I haven't kept any more fasts since the other day. Not that I'm telling everyone at school that. I don't need to give them all another excuse to find me weird. I need to focus on my exams, science and history, of which are out of the way. Most of my fellow classmates are still going strong, fasting and revising. They used to do that at my old school too. Become all pious for a month and then beat the crap out of you the day after Eid. But let's not get into that. The phone has stopped ringing. Great. Now we won't find out who it was or what it was until morning. And proper morning is hours away. We're not going to get any sleep now, are we? We're just going to lie here wondering what the phone call was about. But then again, if it is urgent and someone has died a brutal death, then whoever it is will carry on trying. Oh, there you go. It's bloody ringing again. Hurry up, Dad. Ah, he's picked it up. He said hello. Oh, God. It's gone all quiet now. So that was Ruby. I'll read a little snippet of Yusuf. I'm sitting in my favourite armchair this morning. Yes, the one Ashraf was hogging a few days ago. I'm twiddling my thumbs and listening to Hamza next door, the noisy toddler whose father gave me a slice of birthday cake, which may have been on the same day as Ashraf's visit. I'm also watching the phone, because Hassan hasn't called me yet. He didn't call yesterday either. I'm sure he didn't, though I could be wrong. He usually rings me every morning as he's driving to work, around 8 o'clock to be precise, as he knows I'm awake. I can ignore it the once because my son is a busy man and he may have forgotten, but twice? Oh no, Hassan never forgets to call me. Even if he is late, he will fit that phone call in somehow. I have an uneasy feeling in my chest. Is he okay? I should have mentioned something to Fozia last night. I think I spoke to her last night. It was silly, though, to start a fuss over one missed phone call. Two is a different matter. What did I talk to Fozia about? It was another phone call of me pretending to be right as rain. I am mostly. I have to be. After all my defiance and eagerness to be independent, I cannot crumble now. But something has happened since then. Things seem to have taken a turn for the worst. Like this morning, I have woken up feeling vague. I don't know how else to describe it. I even had a little tumble on the stairs but quickly grabbed the banister with both hands to steady myself. I didn't slip though. This was a different kind of tumble, like my brain forgot to communicate with my legs. I clung onto the banister for longer than I should have. It took me longer to recover. And ever since, I've been slightly cautious with each step, a little anxious with each movement. This vagueness, it's been plaguing me for a while now. I won't admit it to anyone. I can barely admit it to myself. A year is a long time and things change, deteriorate. Over the past few months, every pain and twinge in my body feels more intense. I lament the thought of getting out of bed. I forget things easily. My mind sometimes plays tricks, just like on the night of the burning tower, when I saw you. This was the first time you came right before my eyes, right there. Before that, you were creeping into my thoughts, my dreams. It is clear that you have taken advantage of Zarina's death, The silence has invited you in. You're here to remind me of things that I thought I had buried a long time ago. Maybe this is it. I'm finally losing control, just like the tumble I had on the stairs earlier. I would rather have them every day than lose control of my brain. I have only survived because of my ability to lock things away in remote corners of my mind, corners that may seem that remain dark and obscure, places that I myself cannot bear to even peek into, places that would have people leap back in horror, if only they knew.
Thank you. Even after having, like, I finished reading it, in January? 6 months later, and Yusuf's still pulling on my heartstrings. So we've got a good 15 minutes of Q&A. I'm going to pass the mic on to the Literature Festival peeps. If you want to raise your hand if you've got a question.
Thank you, really. We read your book, and now we've got quite a diverse book group, and every single person absolutely loved it, and they all took something away from it. So I just wanted to say, well done, keep it up.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Hi. My question was, what's your writing process like? Do you carve away time daily? How do you keep that momentum going, especially when you're working on something? But also, you mentioned that you're looking for ideas for book three. So, yeah, what does that process look like for you?
Thank you for your question. So with writing, I feel like, you know, you might hear of rules like, oh, you should write every day and this is what you should be doing. But I think it's different for everybody. And I know that my best time, when I'm at my most optimum, is in the morning at 7 o'clock. I wish it was like later on and I could have a line, but it's not. And I feel like as though I need to get up and just go straight to the desk and start writing. If I start making a coffee, if I do anything else, that's it. It's gone, that creativity. And I feel like you can only, for me anyway, I can only write for maybe 4 hours max. Like, and even then I need breaks in between. Something else that I try to do to, you know, if I'm feeling stuck is I'll get a notebook and I'll just move away from my desk and my laptop and I'll start describing what needs to happen in the scene rather than trying to write it really well. And some of my best writing and my favourite chapters have come from doing that. Everyone's different. Some people love the first draft stage, some people love the editing. I'm definitely an editor more than the first draft. I do find really hard. And, you know, sometimes days go by and, you know, your life happens, you're working, and it's difficult to, you know, write and get anything decent. But sometimes even within 10 minutes, you can do something really amazing. But routine-wise, 7 o'clock every morning, that's where it's at for me.
This is a bit of a confession as well. So I work in a small local college library and we have a very diverse student population, but the staff were not very diverse. And we wanted to get more things to reflect the diversity of our student audience. And we are lacking anything on the Honestly, my brain, it doesn't work. Could you recommend anything we could like use to sort of be diverse and say, look, we have history covering not just the kings and queens of England, but of India and of Pakistan and of this massive event that happened that your grandparents will know about, just so that we've got some inspiration of what we could get. Because we could look and think that's interesting, but actually it's not accurate because it's not my history. I don't want to get the wrong thing. So if you have any recommendations, that would be amazing.
Yeah, definitely. I'll give you a proper list at the end. But just now, for anyone who is interested in the partition, Kavita Puri is an amazing author. I'm sure, have you read her Partition Voices? I thought I saw it on your... So that's amazing. Partition Voices, it's called. And that's amazing because it gives you the history, but instead of giving you a history lesson, it picks out individuals and what they went through, and that's how you learn about the partition. So that's an amazing book. There's also The Great Partition by Yasmin Khan, which was, I mean, I've used that throughout the years academically and just generally dipping in and out. If a book isn't really like, if you struggle to learn about history through a book, there's amazing podcasts at the moment. So there's the Empire podcast. There's also £3 in my pocket, but that's more about that generation that came in the 60s, and it follows them through the 60s, 70s, 80s, like, and then sort of the, you know, the generation that was born here, and it goes through sort of all the history as well. There's so many. But I will give you a better list at the end. Yeah, you're welcome.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I just wanted to ask, you said you did a master's in creative writing. How do you think that that's developed you as a writer? And do you think that it's, like, is it something that you'd recommend to other people?
It gave me the time and the space to write. I was given a scholarship both times. So, you know, I think I left university and I thought, you know, you're going to get into the world of work and I will write that novel. But then for a lot of people, it doesn't happen when, you know, the 9 to 5 kicks in. So it was amazing for me to go from undergraduate to, you know, straight on to my master's and PhD. And I had someone who gave me amazing advice and guidance and suggestions. And, you know, it was amazing. But things are not so great at the moment with the universities, the arts and humanities. You'll have heard, you know, departments being shut down. It's basically under attack. So there's things like this that you can do instead. You don't need one. You don't need a master's or anything to be a writer. You just need, I don't feel like as though you can be taught how to be a writer. I think it's something that you, with opportunities or courses like that, it's something that you know, you develop, you hone your craft. That's what it's more about. So, you know, even a writer's group is brilliant because, you know, if you can find some supportive people where you can share your work with and they can give you feedback as a reader, that's any kind of feedback is, you know, it's just going to make you a better writer. So,
as a white man, I read this book and I found it very moving because it was very educational for me, learning things, whilst at the same time you learn through the writing process of empathy, you feel. But the other thing I felt was this is a universal experience, the experience of an older man traumatised by events from a deep past which is lost to a later generation. And at the same time, some of the trauma of a teenager maybe, because among other communities, people may be traumatised by fears of climate crisis. My question really is, I'm wondering whether you've thought in terms of the potential to use this kind of writing to reach out beyond your own communities and to work towards intercultural enlightenment, if you like, of people from different communities.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. My agent said to me, you have to remember this book isn't about partition. Partition is there. It's one of the stories, but it's about this relationship between these two characters. And exactly as you put it beautifully there. But this isn't an Asian story. This is British history. And these characters are British. And what happened in 1947 was British history, and it's something that we should all know about. And it does feel, you know, because often it does feel like, you know, so many bad things happen in the 20th century, so many bad things are still happening. What's the point of this? Why am I banging on about the partition when, you know, things are happening in the world right now that we can't stop and we can't sort of, you know, challenge? I think it's important, and it's important to know where you've come from and why the world looks the way it does at the moment. And I think growing up, you know, when I was growing up in my history lessons, we didn't learn about the partition. Family didn't talk about it. So then if you kind of say to people, why don't you know about this? How are they supposed to know about it? You know, when the curriculum isn't covering it, your family's not talking about it because it's too painful. And there was this kind of assumption often that, oh, well, you came here to work and earn money and to better your lives and that was it. Not that actually we go back, our countries, our communities, we go back a long way, you know, and that's really important. So, yeah, you know, I'm glad you read it, and it is a book for everyone. And I'm hoping, again, that universal aspect of it speaks to people. You know, I do understand that sometimes, you know, you can pick up a book and you might think this is so far removed from what I know. But I think when you start reading this, it's not, because this sat in Manchester and in Bradford in 2017, and we all know what that feels like. So yeah, there's this big epic backstory about partition, but you know, it's very much a book of like now and what's happening now, I'd say. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and emotions are universal, like human emotions are universal, and I think also like family dynamics, family relationships, that's something that
everybody can resonate with, regardless of ethnicity. So this was absolutely amazing. I enjoyed this so much. And I enjoyed learning all the juicy secrets behind the workings of this novel. No pressure at all for the third one. So thank you so much. You've all been amazing.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival starts on the 27th of June with a huge programme of events, from comedy to crime, music to memoirs. Head to bradfordlitfest.co.uk to book your ticket now.